arahato sama sambuddhasa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Last time when I spoke here, I gave a talk about the body and various meditations on the body, particularly on how to contemplate the body as being made up of 32 parts. And this meditation and this contemplation is to help us to get a more balanced view of the body. Instead of being infatuated with the body and preoccupied with the body and identifying with the body as who we are, this meditation, or the set of meditations that I outlined, are designed to help us to see things as they really are. And in Buddhism, the three characteristics of existence, which the Buddha said apply to all material form, is that they are impermanent, they don't last, they are unsatisfactory because they don't exist independent of causes and conditions, and they're not self, they're not under our control, they don't belong to us. And so in the body meditations we start to reflect directly on the body in the light of these three characteristics. Does the body last forever? No. Is it unsatisfactory because it has to be looked after and cared for and is always breaking down? Yes. And is it under our control? Can we make it do what we want when we want it? Can we stop it from aging? Can we make it well when it's sick? Are we really in control, or does it operate according to its own nature? Yes, it does. And so we apply the kind of contemplations which I outlined to the body, not to become averse to the body, to hate the body, but to help to be more balanced in our attitude to the body. And in today's world, because of the kind of representation of the body in the media, in magazines, television, films, the body is very often held up to be the basis for our identity and for our well-being. And we can very easily become infatuated with the body and think that our happiness depends just on this body. We get a very unbalanced and unrealistic view of what this body can do for us. So these practices are to help us to get a more realistic and balanced idea about the body. And when we see things as they really are, then our attitudes change. So these practices have to be done repeatedly, again and again over time, so that we break through our wrong way of thinking. And one of the similes that the Buddha gave for this process is a person who's blind from birth wraps themselves in a cloth which everyone tells them is lovely. Because they can't see the cloth for themselves, they have no idea that it's actually blotched and stained and not at all attractive. And so they keep on wrapping themselves in this cloth and using it with great enjoyment. And then one day they recover their sight and they see that the cloth which they've been cherishing and which they thought was so beautiful is actually discoloured and stained. And so immediately they throw it away. So when we see things as they really are, our attitudes change, and we deal with that thing in a more appropriate way. Now, someone was telling me that when they were talking about this kind of meditation with their children at home, their children said, "Oh, you Buddhists, you're always looking on the dark side of things. Why can't you enjoy things, Mum? Why have you always got to be looking on the miserable side?" And this is quite understandable coming from a young person. And the Buddha addressed the attitudes that we have to this body in relation to the pride that we take in our youth and the pride that we take in our health. And when we're young and when we're healthy, when everything's going well for us, it's not surprising that we can't see the other side. It's not surprising that we don't want to see the other side. And so for young people, if you just reflect, unless they've had ill health or an accident, this body has been a source of pleasure. It's been a source of increasing self-independence, being able to do more, starting off with having to rely on someone to help you sit up and help you to eat and take you outside. As you grow and get bigger, you can sit up on your own, you can feed yourself, and eventually you can walk outside on your own. And as this body gets bigger and stronger and you're able to do more things with it, your whole horizons expand. And so in youth, this body is this vehicle for getting bigger and better and stronger and for developing this sense of oneself as being independent in the world. And so it's no wonder that it's difficult for young people to relate to this kind of contemplation or to this approach which is trying to see the other side of the body. And very often we can think the same thing. I'll leave this till later, till it really, I really need to reflect on this body. After I'd given this talk last week, someone gave me a newspaper to read. And in the newspaper I saw a very interesting article. And that was the news that Kathy Freeman's husband had just been found to have cancer. And there was this great juxtaposition of two experiences with the body because, of course, Kathy Freeman is an elite athlete and she had been recently suffering from an injury which could possibly take her out of competition. And yet through her great determination and the effort that she put in, she was able to recover from that injury and, if you like, take control of the body, to be able to overcome something which would have put other people out of the picture, and was one day celebrating that she'd been able to do this. And this is one of those situations where you can say, see, we are in control of this body. If you just get good enough, if you just put enough effort in, if you're determined enough, do anything with this body, even mend a fracture. It's true. But the next day, the news of her husband's illness. And this is something which many people face. Sudden, severe illness. This body lets us down. And so that kind of information, just to reflect on that, so that we get the balanced picture. Certainly we can do marvellous things with this body within limitations, but there are limitations. And so that's why we do these practices, which may not be palatable, which may not be everyone's cup of tea. And the world may say that, why bother? What a waste of time. Why put yourself through all of that stuff? Why not just enjoy? And then we can reflect on the this kind of example of going from joy to sadness from one day to the next because of this body. Now, the other reason why we practice these kinds of meditations on the body is not only so that we get a more realistic picture of the body and learn to give up our attachment to this body and to the bodies of others, our unrealistic idea that we can be in control. The other reason why we do it is so that we can let go of our preoccupation with the body in meditation, so that we can turn our attention to the mind. Now, if you just reflect on your experience in meditation, how much of your time and attention is taken up with trying to sit comfortably, trying to get into that posture where it doesn't hurt, where the back doesn't hurt or the neck doesn't hurt or the knees don't hurt. And if you can get into it at the beginning of the sitting, how long is it before you start to notice, hey, it's hurting now? How long can I stand it? What can I do to make that stop hurting? And in the meditation, that's just pointing to what we do in our daily life. We spend so much time trying to be comfortable, preoccupied with this body. And as I said in the media, the emphasis is given to the body. If you look at any magazine, it's full of things to make the home comfortable. Comfortable for the body. To make the body beautiful, the face beautiful, the hair beautiful. Clean up all the bits of the body that we don't like. And yet very little attention is given to cleaning up the mind, to making the mind beautiful. And yet in meditation, eventually, that's where we have to focus our attention, on the mind. And in order to move to the point where we are paying attention to the mind, we have to be willing and able to let go of the body. So first we are paying attention to the body with the mind, and as we become less attached to the body, we can put the body aside for the duration of the meditation and pay attention to the mind with the mind. And for the ordinary untrained person, their conception of the mind is thinking. Thinking, thinking, and thinking. That's the mind. And unless we practice meditation, we have no experience that there is any other thing, any other aspect, any other function in the mind apart from thinking. So what we have to do in the meditation practice is to develop the ability to observe the mind in the same way that we observed the body. And that means, first of all, that we take a meditation object, like the breath, which is the body, but it's an anchor point for our attention. And as we try to anchor our attention on the breath, we notice that the mind wanders away. It may wander away because a sound has arisen, but that sound, that hearing consciousness, very quickly gives rise to thinking. And so we are then thinking about the sound. Or we may have a thought arise in the mind from the past, something that we've just done, and we start thinking about the thought. But if we start to observe our experience in the meditation, we can see that thinking is what preoccupies us. It's thinking that takes us away from the breath. So even when we are distracted by the body, it's not only the experience that's happening in the present, but our thoughts about that experience that we get wound up with. Is my knee going to drop off if I don't move? So there's the initial unpleasant feeling, and then there's the thoughts about it. And sometimes we can notice how stupid those thoughts are, but we can't stop them. The mind just goes on and on and on. And our practice is to come back to the meditation object. But we're only willing to do that if we have realized that the thinking is useless or not necessary or not appropriate right now. If we value the thinking, then we will always say, well, I'll just finish this thought. This is a really important one. Better just think it through to the end, because I won't get another opportunity like now to really sort this out. And so we stay with the thinking. And before we know it, that thought's led to another thought and another thought, and we've lost the meditation object altogether. So the first thing that we notice when we are able to stay with the meditation object is that there is the possibility of a space in the mind without thinking. This is a revelation. This is what we can only really know through meditation practice. But that space without thinking is very quickly filled up. And if we follow the thinking, follow the thoughts that have arisen, then we get carried away again, and that space gets filled up completely, moment after moment after moment after moment. We don't even know whether we're breathing in or breathing out. We're just riding on those thoughts, right in the middle of them. As soon as we know that we've been swept away, then we let go of the thinking and come back again to the breath. And we have to do this over and over and over again to weaken the tendency in the mind to follow those thoughts. And then again, as we stay with the meditation object, we're able to experience a moment of peacefulness, a moment of space, free of thoughts. We don't have to do anything else but just keep on watching the meditation object. And that space arises naturally, and the ease that goes with it arises naturally. And so what we have to do is to start valuing that space. Before we were valuing the thinking, now we have to value the space between the thoughts. And the more we do that, the more we recognize through our own experience that there is something more to the mind than thinking. As we continue to practice this basic technique, we make the space between the thoughts longer and longer. And we're able to stay with the breath moment after moment after moment. That space without thoughts is not empty space, because we're watching the breath. But there's a sense of ease that arises when the thinking starts to subside. And this is the basic practice that we pursue. And the further we're able to go with it, the more the sense of ease and lightness, peace and clarity arises in the mind. And then we have the experience of what else the mind can offer to us apart from thinking and analysing, comparing and contrasting, getting lost in emotions. We discover that there's some inner peace, but it can't be reached through thinking. It has to be reached through the quiet mind. This in itself is a big step to take, because the world only knows peace or pleasure or happiness through sense contact, through getting things that we like to eat, hearing sounds that we consider pleasant, smelling odours that we enjoy, having contact with the body that's comfortable. The ordinary untrained person only knows those ways to find happiness, to find pleasure. But when we meditate, we start to discover a source of happiness that is independent of contact through the senses. And the deeper we go in our practice, that is, the more we're able to stay focused inward rather than going outward, the deeper this peace becomes. But in order to get to that point, we have to really be able to see thinking in its true nature, just as we needed to be able to see the body as it really is, in order to get a more balanced view and to let go of our infatuation with it. So we have to be able to let go of our infatuation with thinking. And so we need to be able to examine thinking in the same way that we examine the body, to see it in the light of the three characteristics of existence, that is, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. Because the ordinary person who's untrained in reflecting on the thoughts thinks that whatever thought arises in the mind is me. It's my thought. It's arising in my mind. It must be mine. And it must be true because I'm thinking it. And not only must it be true and mine, I must act on it. Thinking precedes speech and action. And we automatically believe our thoughts as being true, as being something I have to do because I thought it. Now, normally we don't even reflect in this way. It's just an automatic process. We haven't even considered that thinking might be something that we should reflect on. We just take it as being who I am. Part of me. That's the way I am. But in this training, we are now starting to stand back even from the thought process and to reflect on it. We can only do this once we have developed a little bit of spaciousness in the mind. That is when we've been able to stay with the meditation object long enough to recognize that there is more than just thought in the mind, and then to strengthen that ability to not get swept away by the thoughts as they arise. To observe the thinking without getting lost in the thinking. This is what we call mindfulness. So when we pay attention to the thoughts, we need to be able to reflect on their nature. We can't do that if we're swept away by them. We can only do that when we have a little bit of distance. So as the mind settles down and becomes more peaceful, we can start to notice the thoughts as they're arising, or just after they've arisen. So the first thing that we can ask ourselves is, where did that thought come from? If I think that this thought is me, is mine, is a part of who I am, where did it come from? What gave rise to it? Did it arise out of nowhere? And when we examine in this way, we can notice that thoughts are produced, are conditioned. They're based on something that precedes it, an experience, a previous thought, a sound that reminds us of something, an incident that happened during the day, a movie that we saw. Thoughts are conditioned. They don't have a life of their own. They're produced by our experience. Sometimes we might say, well, this thought just came out of nowhere. It came out of 20 years ago. Why is it arising now? But we can still see it comes out of something. This is as we reflect on this, we can start to see that the thoughts that arise in this way, arising in this way, means that I don't necessarily have to take them as true, as something that I have to act on, as something that has to propel my behaviour in the present moment. It's arisen because of causes and conditions. I don't have to take it as me and mine. And then, is it permanent or impermanent? Well, very often it's difficult to notice the thoughts as they're arising. But we can start to notice them as they're ceasing. Where do they go? Do they stay forever? No, they stay for a while. Even if they get elaborated on, even if they get built on, they stay for a while, they change into something else. Maybe we start thinking about our aunt, and then we start thinking about the food she used to cook when we go to visit her, and then we think about the last time we ate that food with someone else, and then the mind goes off in all sorts of directions. So the original thought changes into something else, and may even change and disappear completely. The next thought arises. Again, if it's so impermanent, so fleeting, so much a passing show, do we have to get involved with it? Do we have to believe it? Do we have to follow it as though it's the absolute truth? And then, is this thought for my happiness or for my suffering? And certainly we have lots of happy thoughts. But if we're trying to meditate and watch the breath, then any thought that arises during that time is for our suffering. It's like a plant that is in the wrong place and we call it a weed. It's only a plant. In another spot it might be just a nice plant, but it's a weed if it's in the place we don't want it to be. And that's the thoughts that arise during our meditation. So it's not that we're trying to hate ourselves for thinking, or hate the thoughts that arise, or get into a battle with the thoughts when they arise. But if we can see them without valuing them in the ordinary way that we do, then we will be able to put them down during the meditation. And as we can put them down, we recognize that they have only as much power as we give them. And we can start to take that kind of experience into our daily life. How many times do we get into trouble because of our thoughts? Because we think that we can't say no to our thoughts. We think that when we think something, we have to do it. We lose control. And this happens to all of us, but it happens in extreme ways to many people. They end up killing someone because they get so angry they have to kill that person. And it's a thought that starts that off, that whole process. They have to take that because they have to have it, even if it belongs to someone else. It starts as a thought. And so once we become more skillful in dealing with thinking during the meditation, we have more control over our thinking in daily life. We understand that this thought is impermanent. It's going to pass away if I can just be present enough not to get swept away by it. It won't last forever. It'll change into something else. It's coming from somewhere. It's coming from causes and conditions. It's not mine. I don't have to own it. I don't have to believe it just because I'm thinking it. And if it's for my suffering, then why should I want to allow it to have control over my life? And in the meditation this evening, we did a simple practice of noting the thoughts as thinking. And this can be very useful. When we are obsessed with thoughts, or when we are finding that the mind is racing, just to label them as thinking, especially with that perception that these thoughts are not in the right place at the right time, this is not what I want right now, it can cut the momentum of the thoughts, cut them right away, not allowing the mind to get involved with the story that goes with the thought. And again, in daily life, when we are getting carried away with our fantasies or carried away with our anger, we can notice that this is just thinking. And this thinking, is it for my happiness or for my suffering? Is it permanent or impermanent? Is this really my property? Do I have to follow it through? To be able to reflect in that way takes the energy out of the thoughts. And then when we do that, we experience for ourselves these thoughts don't have to be believed. They don't have to be acted on. And we start to take control of our thinking mind. And then as we practice this and develop it, particularly in the meditation, we realize that there is this quality in the mind which is apart from thinking. And that in the mind which is free of thinking, we can experience great ease. In order to go deeper in our meditation, we have to see through the thinking mind. In order to experience for ourselves that there is something else. And until we experience that ourselves, we're always going to be questioning whether this meditation is really worthwhile. To get through the early stages, particularly when the thinking mind is so domineering, so dominant, we have to have this determination and the patience to persevere. But the insight, the understanding of what thinking is, will help us to persevere, will help us to keep on making the effort, even when it's difficult. The other thing that we did during the meditation earlier was at the end of the meditation to deliberately bring into the mind particular kinds of thoughts. And this is the other aspect to dealing with the thinking mind. It's not that all thinking is bad. Obviously, we need thinking to go about our daily life. We need to be able to compare things. We need to be able to refer to our previous experience. We need to be able to plan for the future. But we need to keep thinking in its place. When we are able to see what we can do to ourselves through the kind of thoughts that we allow in the mind, then we also can see the benefit of developing particular kinds of thoughts. And these are the thoughts of loving kindness. Loving kindness is one of the emotional states which we deliberately try to generate. It's a feeling of goodwill and friendliness towards ourselves and towards others. And it's something which we have to very deliberately grow if we want it to develop in our own heart. And so we deliberately bring thoughts of loving kindness into the mind. First of all, just as thoughts, just as wishes, just as words which we say to ourselves. But eventually, those thoughts, which are like planting seeds in the mind, give rise to the feeling, the emotion that goes along with them. But we have to keep at it, we have to keep working at it to make those seeds grow. To deliberately change the tone of the mind. When we start to observe the kind of thoughts that go on in our mind, we'll notice that they're very often critical thoughts, critical of ourselves and critical of others. And starting to develop thoughts of kindness, of appreciation towards ourselves, is actually challenging that tendency in the mind. So it's very often quite difficult to get from the thinking stage to the feeling stage. So we have to persist. We have to actively bring those kinds of thoughts into the mind over and over again. And especially after we've been meditating, that's a very good time to do just a few minutes of loving kindness meditation towards ourselves and towards others. Because this is a time when the mind is much more flexible, much more malleable, much more open to suggestion. And even if we just do these few wishes for ourselves and wishes for those who are close to us, wishes for the whole world, regularly, we will find that little by little, there starts to be a change in the feeling that goes along with those thoughts. And so once we start to see that we can have control over the thoughts in this way, we realize the potential there is in the mind for both harm and help. Because if we can do this with our loving thoughts, imagine what we can do with our unkind thoughts. If we repeat them over and over and over again, eventually we're going to believe them. Eventually we're going to feel them. Eventually we're going to produce a mind state which is so strong that we're going to act on it. So this is something for us to experience for ourselves. And if we experience it with loving kindness and we understand that this is possible with negative thoughts as well, we can understand how important it is to start challenging those negative thoughts when they arise in the mind. Just through habit, just through repetition, they gain power in the mind. Once we realize their true nature, that they are surviving because of the power we give them, because of the attention we give them, the priority we give them, the recognition we give them, then we can start to challenge them and little by little reduce their influence in the mind and little by little build up those thoughts which are for our well-being, for our ease, for our happiness. But those loving kindness thoughts are also impermanent. So we have to keep at it. We have to keep on doing it. And if we don't nurture them, then they will die. So from both perspectives, from the perspective of what is good for us and what is hurtful for us, we can see that thinking plays a very powerful role in our well-being. But we can start to take control of those thoughts by understanding them and then working with them. And as we work with them, in our meditation particularly, we become more and more able to let the thoughts go, to stay with the meditation object, and to find the peace that already is present within the mind. We just have to uncover it. So I encourage all of you to continue to persevere with your practice and not to be disheartened when you see how difficult it is to let the thinking go. This is a very simple practice, but it's the foundation practice, and it will take you to great peace and happiness if you persist. So may this teaching be of benefit to you all, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.